Part 3. Hell. Chapter 11. Complacencies of the Penoir. Sugar, coffee, tea, and chocolate. Long ago, motivated by dwindling resources and changing climate, our proto-hominid ancestors learned to test the natural products in the environment as sources of food. Modern primates, such as baboons, still do this. An unusual or never-before-encountered source of food is approached gingerly, examined carefully for visual appearance and odor, and then tentatively placed in the mouth and held there, not swallowed. After a few moments, the animal makes the decision to swallow the morsel or to spit it out. Such a procedure has been repeated uncounted times over the long ages of human dietary definition. Obviously, a balance must be struck between excluding foods that would be outright injurious to the individual's health and reproductive ability and including as many sources of nutrition as possible. Evolutionary logic dictates that in situations of food scarcity, those animals able and willing to tolerate many marginal foods will be more evolutionarily successful than those that can accept only a limited number of items into their diet. In other words, there will be pressure on a given animal to broaden its definition of what are acceptable foods by broadening its tastes. Broadening our taste. Broadening of tastes or acquiring a taste is a process that is learned. It is a process with both a psychological and biochemical component. The process of acquiring a taste is an extremely complex one. On the one hand, it entails overcoming the inertia of established habits, those habits that exclude the potential new food item, seeing it as exotic, unfamiliar, poisonous, or associated with enemies or social outcasts. And on the other hand, it involves an adaptation to a chemically exotic food. This process brings into action involuntary systems such as the immune system. It also involves psychological mechanisms such as wanting to accept the new food item for reasons that may be as much social as nutritional. In the case of hallucinogenic plants, the shifts in self-image and societal role that often follow their acceptance are rapid and massive. But we should remember that hallucinogens are at the dramatic end of this scale. What of the countless plants that impart flavoring, but confer little nutritional value and negligible psychoactivity? They too have managed to become items habitually used by human beings. In fact, they went from being the exotic luxuries of a tiny leisure class in Roman times to commercial commodities that focused the vast European efforts at exploration and colonization, that drove the engines of mercantilism and empire building, which replaced the inward-turned medieval stasis in Christian Europe. Variety is the spice of life, is an adage familiar to us all. Yet when we examine the impact of plants and plant products on the history of human beings, it seems more true to say that spice is the variety of life. Medieval times and their clothes are a case in point. Dominator culture has never been more powerfully entrenched than in Christian Europe after the eclipse of the Roman Empire. And it probably is safe to say that scarcely ever have human populations existed in such a prolonged situation of drug scarcity and lack of chemical stimulation. Variety, which promotes learning and eases boredom, had too long been suppressed in Europe. Medieval Europe was one of the most constipated, neurotic, and woman-hating societies ever to exist. It was a society dying to escape from itself, a society obsessed with moral rectitude and sexual repression. It was a society chained to the land, ruled by gouty, beef-eating men wearing dresses but suppressing women. Is it any wonder, then, that dyes and spices, hardly the stuff of social revolutions, became an absolute mania for medieval Europe? Such was the strength of this mania that the arts of shipbuilding and navigation, and the banking and the trading industries, all turned to serve the near addiction that most Europeans felt for these things. Spices gave food, and hence life, a variety never known before. Dyes, new dyeing techniques, and exotic fabrics revolutionized fashion. Life without spice. It is difficult for most people born into a society of abundance, sexual gratification, and high-definition TV to imagine the stultifying dullness of most of the societies of the past. The splendor of the great societies of the past was essentially just a display of variety, variety in colors, fabrics, materials, and visual design. Such displays of variety were particularly the prerogative of the ruler and the court. The novelty of the costumes and the appointments of the court was somehow a direct index of its power. Thus, it was when the emerging bourgeoisie of the late Middle Ages began importing dyes and spices, silks, and fine manufactured objects into Europe. I can personally attest to the power of color and variety over the human imagination. My periods of jungle isolation doing fieldwork in the upper Amazon taught me how quickly the bewildering multiplicity of civilized life can be forgotten and then hungered for almost like the withdrawal from a powerful drug. After weeks in the jungle, one's mind is filled with plans for the restaurants to be visited once back in civilization, the music to be heard, the movies seen. Once, after many days in the rainforest, I went to a village to ask permission to make plant collections in the tribal area. The only high-tech intrusion into the primitive circumstances of the tribe was a cheesecake calendar brought from Iquitos and proudly affixed to the thatched wall directly behind the headman of the village. As I talked with him, my gaze returned again and again to the calendar, not the content, but the colors, magenta, cyan, and apricot. The terrible and obsessive attraction to variety was as haunting as the lure of any drug. The dyes and spices of the more technically advanced and aesthetically refined world of Islam entered the bloodstream of dreary Christian Europe with the force of a hallucinogenic drug. Cinnamon, cloves, nutmeg, mace, and cardamom, and dozens of other exotic spices, flavorings, and dyes arrived to brighten the palate and the wardrobe of a wool-swaddled beer and bread culture. Our own culture during the last few years has seen a similar, though more superficial, trend in the rise of the yuppie craze for novelty and new exotic restaurants from ethnic to nouvelle. As schoolchildren, we are taught that the spice trade ended the Middle Ages and created the basis of modern trade and commerce. What we are not aware of is the fact that the breakup of Christian medieval Europe occurred as a result of an epidemic obsession with the new, the exotic, and the delightful, in short, with consciousness-expanding substances. Drugs such as coffee, wormwood, and opium, dyes, silks, rare woods, gems, and even human beings were brought back to Europe and displayed almost like the plunder of a looted extraterrestrial civilization. The notion of Oriental splendor, with its luxury, its sensuality, and its unexpectedly outré design motifs, acted to transform not only aesthetic conventions, but canons of social behavior and individual self-image. The names of cities of the Silk Road, such as Samarkand and Ecbatana, became mantras, bespeaking worlds of refinement and luxury previously associated only with paradise. Social boundaries were dissolved, old problems were seen in a new light, and new secular classes emerged to challenge the power monopoly of popes and kings. In short, there was a sudden acceleration of novelty and appearance of new social forms, the telltale tracks of a quantum leap forward in the power of the European imagination. Once again, pursuit of plants and of the mental stimulation they induce was propelling a portion of the human family into experimentation with new social forms, new technologies, and a sudden expansion of language and imagination. Pressure to expand the spice trade remade the arts of navigation, shipbuilding, diplomacy, warfare, geography, and economic planning. Once again, the unconscious drive to mimic and thus partly recapture the lost symbiosis with a vegetable world was acting as a catalyst to dietary experimentation and to a restless quest for new plants and new relationships with plants, including new forms of intoxication. Enter sugar. When the thirst for variety was slaked by massive and continuous importation of spices, dyes, and flavorings, the infrastructure that had been put in place turned its attention to fulfilling other cravings for variety, specifically to the production and shipping of sugar, of chocolate, tea, and coffee, and of distilled alcohol, all of which are drugs. Our present global trading system was created to cater to people's inherent need for variety and stimulation. It did this with a single-minded intensity that brooked no interference from the church or the state. Neither moral scruples nor physical barriers were able to stand in its way. Now we may appear to ourselves to have succeeded only too well. Now any spice or drug, no matter how restricted its traditional area of use, can be identified and produced or synthesized for rapid export and sale to hungry markets anywhere on the globe. Worldwide pandemics of substance abuse now become possible. The importation of tobacco smoking into Europe in the 16th century was the first and most obvious example. It was followed by many others, ranging from the forced spread of opium use in China by the British, through the opium craze in 18th-century England, to the spread of distilled alcohol abuse among the North American Indian tribes. Of the many new commodities that made their way into Europe during the breakup of the medieval stasis, one in particular emerged as the new spice or drug of choice. This was cane sugar. Sugar had been known for centuries as a rare medicinal substance. The Romans knew that it was derived from a bamboo-like grass, but the tropical conditions needed for the cultivation of sugarcane ensured that sugar would be a rare and imported commodity in Europe. Only in the 19th century, at the encouragement of Napoleon I, were sugar beets developed as an alternative to cane sugar. Sugarcane is known to occur as a wild plant, and the genus is well represented in tropical Asia, and at least 5 species are native to India. Sugarcane, Saccharum officinarum, has doubtless undergone considerable hybridization during its long history of domestication. The Persian king Khusra I, AD 531 to 578, whose court was near Jundishapur, dispatched envoys to India to investigate rumors of exotic drugs. Among those drugs brought to Jundishapur from India was sukar, Persian shakar or shakar, Sanskrit sarkara, our sugar, unknown to Herodotus and Tejas, but known to Nearchus and Onesicritus as reed honey, supposed to have been made from reeds by bees. Legend relates that Khusra discovered a store of sugar amongst the treasures taken in 527 at the capture of Dastagrid. The juice of the sugar cane was purified and made into sugar in India about 8300, and now the cane began to be cultivated about Jundishapur, where there were sugar mills at an early date. At that time and for long afterwards, sugar was used only to sweeten otherwise bitter medicines. It was not until much later that it began to replace honey as an ordinary means of sweetening. Sugar reached England around 1319 and was popular in Sweden by 1390. It was an expensive and exotic novelty, mostly found in its traditional role in medicine. Sugar made palatable the foul-tasting mixture of medicinal herbs, entrails, and other materials typical of the medieval pharmacopoeia. In the age before antibiotics, it was commonly used to pack wounds before binding them, as the desiccant action of the sugar may have aided healing. The Spanish planted sugarcane in their Caribbean holdings, and they can claim the dubious distinction of introducing slavery into the New World for the purpose of producing sugar. Until 1550, the only sugar imported from the Western Hemisphere consisted of a few loaves brought as proof of the possibility of production or as mere curiosities. The plantings in West Atlantic islands and the New World had no effect on production, distribution, or prices until the latter half of the 16th century, and only became dominant from about 1650. Sugar as addiction. Is it stretching a point to discuss sugar in a history of human drug use? It is not. Sugar abuse is the world's least discussed and most widespread addiction, and it is one of the hardest of all habits to kick. Sugar addicts may be maintenance users or they may be binge eaters. The depth of serious sugar addiction are exemplified by bulimics, who may binge on sugar-saturated food and then induce vomiting or use a laxative to purge to enable them to eat more sugar. Imagine if a similar practice were associated with heroin addiction. How much more odious and insidious the use of heroin would then seem. As with all stimulants, ingestion of sugar is followed by a brief euphoric rush, which is itself followed by depression and guilt. Sugar addiction rarely occurs alone as a syndrome. Mixed addictions, for example sugar and caffeine, are more common. There are other destructive patterns of drug use that accompany sugar abuse. Some addicts use diet pills to help them control their soaring body weight and then tranquilizers to mitigate the jitteriness caused by the diet pills. Sugar abuse is often involved in the development of serious alcohol abuse. An absolute correlation has been shown between high sugar consumption and high alcohol intake outside meals. After alcohol and tobacco, sugar is the most damaging addictive substance consumed by human beings. Its uncontrolled use can be a major chemical dependence. In describing sugar addicts, Janice K. Phelps has said, "The people we are describing are addictive people who are indeed addicted to one of the most powerful substances to be found anywhere, the refined sugars. Their addiction to sugar is a real, harmful, highly damaging health problem, just as debilitating as addiction to any other substance. Like any addiction, when their chemical isn't supplied, they suffer identifiable withdrawal symptoms. Like any addiction, the process of feeding their physiological hunger with a chemical is destructive to the body, and like any addiction, the point may be reached when supplying the chemical becomes as painful as withdrawing from it. the cycle of chemical dependence becomes both entrenched and intolerable. Sugar and slavery. The distortion and dehumanizing of human institutions and human lives caused by crack cocaine today is nothing compared with what the European desire for sugar did in the 17th and 18th centuries. One may argue that something approaching slave labor is typical of the early stages with cocaine production, but the difference is that it is not slavery sanctioned by mendacious popes and openly pursued by corrupt but legitimate governments. A further difference must be noted. Brutal as it is, the modern drug trade is not involved in anything resembling the wholesale kidnapping, transporting, and mass murder of huge populations, as was done to further the process of sugar production. True, the roots of slavery in Europe reach far back. During the Golden Age of Periclean Athens, fully two-thirds of the city's residents were slaves. In Italy at the time of Julius Caesar, perhaps one-half of the population were slaves. Under the Roman Imperium, slavery became increasingly insupportable. Slaves had no civil rights, and in court disputes their testimony was acceptable only if it had been obtained by torture. If a slaveholder were to die suddenly or under suspicious circumstances, then all of his slaves, without regard to guilt or innocence, were quickly put to death. It is fair to say that the reliance of the Imperium on the institution of slavery must mitigate any admiration that we might feel for the grandeur that was Rome. In truth, the grandeur of Rome was the grandeur of a pigsty masquerading as a military brothel. Slavery diminished with the dissolution of the empire, as all social institutions dissolved into the chaos of the early Dark Ages. Feudalism replaced slavery with serfdom. Serfdom was somewhat better than slavery. A serf could at least maintain a home, marry, till the land, and participate in communal life. Most important, perhaps, a serf could not be separated from or transported off the land. When the land was sold, the serf nearly always went with it. In 1432, Prince Henry, the navigator of Portugal, who was more manager and entrepreneur than explorer, established the first commercial cane sugar plantation in Madeira. Plantings of sugar were made in the other eastern Atlantic holdings of Portugal more than 60 years before there was contact with the New World. More than 1,000 men, including debtors, convicts, and unconverted Jews, were taken from Europe to work in the sugar operations. Their condition was one of quasi-servitude, somewhat akin to the penal colonists and indentured servants who populated Australia and some Middle Atlantic American colonies. Sugarcane was the first crop to be introduced into commercial cultivation in the New World. It is reliably estimated that by 1530, less than 40 years after the initial European contact, there were more than a dozen sugar plantations operating in the West Indies. In his book Seeds of Change, Henry Hobhouse writes of the beginning of African enslavement. In 1443, one of Prince Henry's returning captains brought news of a capture at sea of a crew of black Arabs and Muslims. These men, who were of mixed Arab-Negro parentage and Muslims, claimed that they were of a proud race and unfit to be bondsmen. They argued forcefully that there were in the hinterland of Africa many heathen blacks, the children of Ham, who made excellent slaves and who they could enslave in exchange for their freedom. Thus began the modern slave trade, not the transatlantic trade which was yet to come, but its precursor, the trade between Africa and southern Europe. Hobhouse goes on to describe sugar slavery in the New World. Sugar slavery was of quite a different order. It was the first time since the Roman latifundia that mass slavery had been used to grow a crop for trade, not subsistence, in a big way. It was also the first time in history that one race had been uniquely selected for a servile role. Spain and Portugal voluntarily abjured the enslavement of East Indian, Chinese, Japanese, or European slaves to work in the Americas. The slave trade was itself a kind of addiction. The early importation of African slave labor into the New World was for one purpose only, to support an agricultural economy based on sugar. The craze for sugar was so overwhelming that 1,000 years of Christian ethical conditioning meant nothing. An outbreak of human cruelty and bestiality of incredible proportions was blandly accepted by the institutions of polite society. Let us be absolutely clear. Sugar is entirely unnecessary to the human diet. Before the arrival of industrial cane and beet sugar, humanity managed well enough without refined sugar, which is nearly pure sucrose. Sugar contributes nothing that cannot be gotten from some other easily available source. It is a kick, nothing more. Yet for this kick, the dominator culture of Europe was willing to betray the ideals of the Enlightenment by its collusion with slave traders. In 1800, virtually every ton of sugar imported into England had been produced with slave labor. The ability of the ego-dominator culture to suppress these realities is astonishing. If it seems that too much ire is vented on the sugar habit, it is because in many ways the addiction to sugar seems a distillation of all the wrong-headed attitudes that attend our thinking about drugs. Sugar and the Dominator Style. When temporal distance from the original partnership paradise increases, when the connection with the vegetable feminine matrix of planetary life slips far into the past, then the hold of cultural neurosis increases and manifestations of unchecked ego and dominator theories of social organization proliferate. Slavery, almost unknown during the medieval period, when the notion of private property restricted ownership of anything to a privileged few, returned with a vengeance to fill the need for manpower in the labor-intensive colonial cultivation of sugar. Thomas Hobbes' vision of human society as the inevitable subjugation of the weak by the strong, and Jeremy Bentham's notion of the ultimate economic basis of all social worth, signal that values that seek to nurture the earth and to participate with it in a life of natural emotive balance have been forsaken for the rapacious self-centeredness of Faustian science. The soul of the planet, shrunken by Christian monotheism to the dimensions of a human being, is finally denied any existence at all by the heirs of Cartesian rationalism. The stage is then set for the evolution of a human self-image that is entirely disensouled, adrift in a dead universe devoid of meaning and without moral compass. Organic nature is seen as war, meaning becomes contextual, and the cosmos is rendered meaningless. This process of deepening cultural psychosis, an obsession with ego, money, and the sugar-alcohol-drug complex, reaches its culmination in the mid-20th century with Sartre's appalling assertion that nature is mute. Nature is not mute, but modern man is deaf, made deaf because he is unwilling to hear the message of caring, balance, and cooperation that is nature's message. In our state of denial, we must proclaim nature mute. How else to avoid facing the awful crimes we have committed for centuries against nature and each other? The Nazis said that Jews were not true human beings and that their mass murder was thus not of any consequence. Some industrialists and politicians use a similar disensouling argument to excuse the destruction of the planet, the maternal matrix necessary to all life. Only a terminal addiction to the ego and styles of brutal domination could give rise to a mass mental environment in which such statements could appear plausible, let alone true. Sugar stands at a watershed in such matters. For sugar and the caffeine drugs that spread with it reinforce and support industrial civilization's unreflecting emphasis on efficiency at the price of archaic human values. The Drugs of Gentility. In the opening lines of his magnificent poem, Sunday Morning, Wallace Stevens delivers an image of radiant transcendence and the familiar and ordinary worthy of Cézanne. Complacencies of the peignoir and late, coffee and oranges in a sunny chair, and the green freedom of a cockatoo, upon a rug mingled to dissipate, the holy hush of ancient sacrifice. Stevens's lines evoke an aura of genteel satiety that surrounds the drug caffeine. Sunday Morning reminds us that our stereotyped notion of what constitutes drugs is strained when we are asked to consider such delicate accessories of bourgeois sensibility as tea, coffee, and cocoa, as being in the same category as heroin and cocaine. Yet, all are drugs. Our unconscious striving to find our way back to the sensory ratios of prehistory has led us to develop countless variations on the act of paying homage to plant-based psychoactivity. Mild stimulants, with non-destructive or manageable impact, have been a part of the diet of primates since long before the emergence of hominids. Caffeine is the alkaloid that lies at the basis of much of the human involvement with plants that stimulate. Caffeine is a powerful stimulator well below the toxic dose. It occurs in tea and coffee and in numerous other plants such as Ilex paraguariensis, the source of mate, or Paulinia yoco, an appetite-suppressing Amazonian liana, which have their own localized but ancient and highly ritualized styles of use. Caffeine is bitter, and the inevitable discovery that it could be made more palatable with the addition of honey or sugar set the stage for the very prevalent and little-remarked synergistic effect that occurs between sugar and the various caffeine beverages. Sugar's tendency to become addictive is reinforced if sugar is also being used to make the ingestion of a stimulating alkaloid such as caffeine more palatable. Sugar is culturally defined by us as a food. This definition denies that sugar can act as a highly addictive drug, yet the evidence is all around us. Many children and compulsive eaters live in a motivational environment primarily ruled by mood swings resulting from cravings for sugar. Coffee and tea, new alternatives to alcohol. For all practical purposes, we can say that tea, coffee, and cocoa were introduced simultaneously into England in the 1650s. For the first time in its history, Christian Europe had an alternative to drinking alcohol. All three were stimulants, all were brewed with hot water that had been boiled, and thus rendered free from the then rampant problem of waterborne diseases, and all required copious amounts of sugar. The sugar craze promoted coffee, tea, and chocolate use, which in turn promoted sugar consumption, and the new stimulants were grown in the same colonial holdings then proving so profitable in the production of sugar. Tea, coffee, and cocoa held out the possibility of crop diversification in the colonies, and hence the greater economic stability for both colony and mother country. By 1820, many thousands of tons of tea were being imported into Europe each year, with about 30 million pounds being consumed in the United Kingdom alone. The tea for the European market all came from the southern Chinese coastal city of Canton, from the mid-17th to the early 19th centuries. The tea buyers were not allowed to penetrate inland, nor were they privy to any of the details of the cultivation and cropping of the tea plant. As Hobhouse writes, "History's joke on Europe is that for nearly two centuries, a commodity was imported halfway across the world, and that a huge industry grew up involving as much as 5% of England's entire gross domestic product, and yet no one knew anything about how tea was grown, prepared, or blended." Such ignorance was no barrier to the commercial exploitation of tea. However, the Turkish capture of Constantinople in 1453 certainly was. When trade routes through the eastern Mediterranean were in the hands of the Turk, there was considerable pressure on the sciences of navigation and shipbuilding to perfect the ocean route to the east via the Cape of Africa. The route was discovered in 1498 by Vasco da Gama. When Dutch and Portuguese navigators eventually reached the Moluccas in eastern Indonesia, then called the Spice Islands, spices became much cheaper in Europe, and the struggle among all parties to create monopolies was joined. The type of organization best able to maintain a monopoly was the trading company, a group of merchants drawn together to reduce capital risks and competition. The large, well-armed ships of the various East India companies spelled the end of the age of the self-employed merchant captain. The British East India Company, destined to become the most important of the trading companies, was founded in 1600. From that date until 1834, when free trade liberals opened the tea trade to all interested parties, the company controlled the tea trade to its great advantage. The British East India Company was believed to add at least a third to the price of tea, thus taking £100 a ton out of the 375,000 tons imported during the 18th century. This global figure obscures the rise, on the same basis, of the East India Company's cut from a sum equivalent to $17 million at the beginning of the century to an annual equivalent of $800 million in 1800. The East India Company was big business, hated and loathed by smugglers and consumers alike, and a symbol of corrupt, complacent monopoly. Tea brews a revolution. Toward the end of the 18th century, the tea trade was in crisis, and the government of Lord North made a series of ill-considered decisions that were not only to ruin the tea trade, but were also to lose England her colonies in North America. North's strategy was to sell tea at reduced prices in the colonies, thus diminishing surpluses and driving smuggler competitors out of business. He also sought to place a small and, he imagined, inconsequential tax on tea going to the colonies, simply to force the unruly colonists to submit to imperial authority. As is common knowledge, this tea tax was the straw that broke the camel's back in the political foment that was then gripping the American colonies. On December 16, 1773, angry colonial radicals in Boston turned on His Majesty's tea ships and destroyed their cargo. The salty tea of revolution was brewed that night. And there were other tea parties at New York, Charleston, Savannah, and Philadelphia. The affair might have passed off in a few weeks had not the British response of closing the port of Boston made the Declaration of Independence inevitable. By the early 1800s, the tea trade was showing signs of strain. On the European continent, the Napoleonic Wars had left coffers depleted. The response had been to print paper money unsecured by gold, and this practice eventually resulted in serious inflation. Costs rose, product values rose much less, resulting in economic misery. The panacea to this economic impasse was opium. Exploitation cycles. The opium trade was nothing less than British terrorism waged against the population of China until the Chinese government's restrictions against the importation of opium were totally done away with. There is in these events a pattern that has been repeated in our own century. Just as the dealers of the drug tea turned to opium when their tea market suffered depression, so did Western intelligence groups such as the CIA and the French Secret Service turn their attention to the importation of cocaine in the 80s, after having lost near monopoly on heroin to the heroin-dealing mullahs of the Iranian Revolution. The history of commercial drug synergies, the way in which one drug has been cynically encouraged and used to support the introduction of others, over the past 500 years is not pleasant to contemplate. Perhaps that is why the exercise is so rarely undertaken. The cycles began with sugar. As discussed, sugar, whose existence depended on a savage slave trade, deepened its claim on consumers throughout the 16th century. The 17th century introduction of tea, coffee, and chocolate only drove the craze for sugar to new heights. Through its use in caffeine drinks and distilled alcohol, sugar played a major indirect role in furthering the dominator culture's suppression of the underclass and of women of all classes. Slavery to drugs is a tired metaphor, but in the case of sugar, the metaphor was made horribly real. When the tea market collapsed, the distributing system that had been put in place and capitalized by the British East India Company turned to the production and selling of opium and the exploitation of the Chinese population, which was outside of the colonial system proper. The invention of morphine, 1803, and then heroin, 1873, carries us to the threshold of the 20th century. Alarmed social reformers who attempted to legislate drug use only succeeded in driving it underground. There it remains, controlled today not by robber baron corporations operating under public charter, but by international crime cartels often posing as intelligence agencies. It is, as William Burroughs has remarked, not a pretty picture. Since the age of exploration, drugs and plant products have become increasingly important factors in the equations of international diplomacy. No longer are the distant tropical regions and peoples of the world to languish unattended by the rapacious eye of the white man. They have become production areas populated by an indentured labor force and expected to provide raw materials and a ready market for finished goods. Like the maenads lost in the transport of Dionysian fury, the sugar-intoxicated dominator economies of Europe sought to devour their own children. Coffee. The 11th-century Persian polymath Avicenna, who in 1037 became history's first recorded death from opium overdose, was one of the first to write about coffee, though it had been in use for some time in Ethiopia and Arabia, where the source plant occurred wild. On the Arabian Peninsula, it has long been known that coffee was a plant of marvelous properties. There is even an apocryphal story that when the prophet lay ill, he was visited by the archangel Gabriel, who offered him coffee to restore him to health. Because of the plant's long association with the Arabs, Linnaeus, the great Danish naturalist and the inventor of modern scientific taxonomy, named the plant Coffea arabica. When coffee was introduced to Europe, it was used as a food or medicine. The oil-rich berries were pulverized and mixed with fat. Later, ground coffee was mixed into wine and cooked to provide what must have been a quite stimulating and intense refreshment. Coffee was not brewed as a drink until around 1100 in Europe, and only in the 13th century did the modern practice of roasting coffee beans begin in Syria. Though coffee was an old-world plant and was used in some circles a long time before tea, nevertheless tea cleared the way for the popularity of coffee. Their stimulant properties made caffeine in coffee, and its close cousin theobromine in tea, the ideal drugs for the Industrial Revolution. They provided an energy lift, enabling people to keep working at repetitious tasks that demanded concentration. Indeed, the tea and coffee break is the only drug ritual that has never been criticized by those who profit from the modern industrial state. Nevertheless, it is well established that coffee is addictive, causes stomach ulcers, can aggravate heart conditions, and can cause irritability and insomnia, and in excessive doses, even tremors and convulsions. contra coffee. Coffee has not been without its detractors, but they have always been in the minority. Coffee was widely blamed for the death of the French minister Colbert, who died of stomach cancer. Goethe blamed his habitual café latte for his chronic melancholia and his attacks of anxiety. Coffee has also been blamed for causing what Lewin called an excessive state of brain excitation, which becomes manifest by a remarkable loquaciousness, sometimes accompanied by accelerated association of ideas. It may also be observed in coffeehouse politicians who drink cup after cup of black coffee, and by this abuse are inspired to profound wisdom on all earthly events. The tendency to excessive raving after coffee drinking apparently lay behind several edicts against coffee issued in Europe in 1511. The Prince of Waldeck pioneered an early version of the drug snitch program when he offered a reward of $10 to anyone who would report a coffee drinker to the authorities. Even servants were rewarded if they informed on employers who had sold them coffee. By 1777, however, authorities in continental Europe recognized the suitability of coffee for use by the pillars of dominator society, the clergy and the aristocracy. Punishment for a coffee offense by members of less privileged classes was usually a public caning followed by fines. And, of course, coffee was once widely suspected of causing impotence. It has frequently been stated that the drinking of coffee diminishes sexual excitability and gives rise to sterility. Though this is a mere fable, it was believed in former times. Olearius says in the account of his travels that the Persians drink the hot black water chawe, whose property it is to sterilize nature and extinguish carnal desires. A sultan was so greatly attracted by coffee that he became tired of his wife. The latter one day saw a stallion being castrated and declared that it would be better to give the animal coffee, and then it would be in the same state as her husband. The Princess Palatine Elizabeth Charlotte of Orléans, the mother of the dissipated Regent Philip II, wrote to her sister, "Coffee is not so necessary for Protestant ministers as for Catholic priests, who are not allowed to marry and must remain chaste. I am surprised that so many people like coffee, for it has a bitter and a bad taste. I think it tastes exactly like foul breath." The physician-explorer Raoulf of Augsburg, who later became the discoverer of the first tranquilizer, the plant extract Raoulfia, found coffee apparently long established and widely traded in Asia Minor and Persia when he visited the area in the mid-1570s. Accounts such as Raoulf soon made coffee a fad. Coffee was introduced in Paris in 1643, and within 30 years, there were over 250 coffee houses in the city. In the years immediately preceding the French Revolution, there were nearly 2,000 coffee establishments operating. If wild talk is the mother of revolution, then certainly coffee and coffee houses must be its midwife. Chocolate. The introduction of chocolate into Europe is almost no more than a coda to the craze for caffeine stimulation that began with the Industrial Revolution. Chocolate, made from the ground beans of a native Amazonian tree, Theobroma cacao, contains only small amounts of caffeine, but is rich in caffeine's near relative theobromine. Both are chemicals with close relatives that occur endogenously in normal human metabolism. Like caffeine, theobromine is a stimulant, and the addictive potential of chocolate is significant. Cacao trees had been introduced into central Mexico from tropical South America centuries before the arrival of the Spanish conquistadors. There they had a major sacramental role in Maya and Aztec religion. The Maya also used cacao beans as the equivalent of money. The Aztec ruler Montezuma was said to be seriously addicted to ground cacao. He drank his chocolate unsweetened in a cold water infusion. A mixture of ground chocolate and psilocybin-containing mushrooms was served to the guests at the coronation feast of Montezuma II in 1502. Cortez was informed of the existence of cacao by his mistress, a Native American woman named Dona Marina, who had been given to Cortez as one of 19 young women offered in tribute to Montezuma. Assured by Dona Marina that cacao was a powerful aphrodisiac, Cortez was eager to begin cultivation of the plant. He wrote to the Emperor Charles V, "On the lands of one farm, 2,000 trees have been planted, the fruits are similar to almonds, and are sold in a powdered state." Shortly thereafter, chocolate was imported into Spain, where it was soon extremely popular. Nevertheless, the spread of chocolate was slow, perhaps because so many new stimulants were then vying for European attention. Chocolate did not appear in Italy or the Low Countries until 1606. It reached France and England only in the 1650s. Except for a brief period during the reign of Frederick II, when it became the favorite vehicle for poisons used by professional poisoners, chocolate has steadily increased in popularity and annual tonnage produced. It is extraordinary that in the relatively short span of 2 centuries, 4 stimulants, sugar, tea, coffee, and chocolate, could have emerged out of local obscurity and become a basis for vast mercantile empires, defended by the greatest military powers ever known to that time and supported by the newly reintroduced practice of slavery. Such is the power of the cup that cheers, but not inebriates.